You're listening to News and Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, debt relief for Africa, a failing FBI, an apology for anti-lynching laws, and a teen gets a scholarship from death row. Joining us to discuss this from our Chicago bureau, Don Turner Trice, a reporter and columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Robert George, editorial writer for the New York Post, joins us via phone from New York. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, comes to us from Maryland. Before we get started, folks, we note that this week saw Tony Blair and President Bush meet. Yesterday, they talked about some of what they met about in terms of their hopes and wants to secure debt relief for Africa. We're going to take a listen to what George Bush had to say.
As we work with African nations to develop democratic institutions and vibrant economies that will provide greater opportunity for all Africans, we must also address emergency needs. I'm pleased to announce the United States will provide approximately $674 million of additional resources to respond to humanitarian emergencies in Africa.
That being said, not everyone was pleased with that dollar amount, and it's suggested that that will not wipe out the entire debt. And some are surprised that they did not see the Bush administration go even further in their commitment to eliminate this debt. This is high on Tony Blair's radar screen, and because of his response and dedication to the president for the war, many thought that they would see more of an effort by the Bush administration. We're going to listen to what Tony Blair had to say yesterday.
It's not just about resources. It's also about debt, it's about trade, it's about making sure that we deal with these diseases, HIV/AIDS, malaria, TB, polio, that are killing so many people. It's about conflict resolution and having the proper peacekeeping and peace enforcement mechanisms.
Don Turner Trice, this is a mandate that Tony Blair wants to give to other Western leaders to say that we need to take a look at this and rectify this situation, some of the situation based on some of the things that we have done in the past that have caused Africa to be in the place it is in. How do you look at this situation, in particular Bush's response?
Well, the only images out of Africa that we see in the mass media are often negative ones. We see the poverty, the famine, the AIDS crisis, the genocide, and they all seem so intractable. I think a lot of Americans question whether money will really help Africa, so there really isn't this huge public outcry. So whatever the president does, whatever he offers, he can pretty much do what he wants. But Africa, what African nations are saying that they need is need to become more self-sufficient is debt relief. And the president talks about Africa being a centerpiece of his foreign policies. But there aren't concrete plans to erase that debt, and especially when you have some African countries that are spending three times as much on debt relief as they are on health care. So there's a real problem here. We as Americans, we give a lot, but we remain outranked by other countries in the amount devoted to aid as a percentage of our economy.
George, we should.
I mean, I
go ahead, Robert.
I mean, that's. I mean, I think that's partly true. At the same time, though, the United States is also looked at as being one of those of a first resort when it comes to, say, sending military assistance when you've got problems in Liberia and things like that. But that aside, I think one of the main problems that you have here is one that has been for a while that. Even though there has been some regime change in various parts of Africa, some of the same intractable problems in terms of corruption and a kind of petty oligarchical dictatorships are still there. And there's this kind of question as to whether you're going to want to just try and wipe the slate clean by getting rid of all the debt, or still trying to work to get some of these systemic governmental problems resolved in Africa first before another wave of economic aid comes in.
George, we should note that $674 million is not new money. That money had already, quite frankly, been pledged. And some say that there are reports that Bush offered Blair little support in mobilizing other world leaders to change the climate and assisting Africa.
That's exactly what I was going to say. This is repackaged. As you go up and reannounce something that has already been approved by Congress, and it really doesn't really address the real problem. Now, my fellow panelists earlier talked about the stereotypes that come out of Africa, but the Corporate Council on Africa, where there's about 200 U.S. firms doing business in Africa, point out that last year, Africa saw the highest rate of return on investment than any region in the world. So they're encouraging more investment. That's something you don't hear about Africa. You hear the things like Robert just said a while ago about the dictators, the corruption, which we know is true in some countries, but it's not across the board. But still, in terms of a business proposition here, they have the highest rate of return. And so we should be investing in Africa in a lot of ways from the corporate standpoint. But so also, until we can really get rid of this debt relief, all it means is we'll be giving the money, and the money be coming right back to us, and you really don't help improve the problem.
But George, you know, just to follow up what you said, then why don't we, instead of thinking of it in a construct of debt relief for Africa, why don't you reward the countries that have made like real improvements in rooting out corruption and moving towards democratic reforms and so forth, and focus the attention there rather than just making some kind of blanket statement and saying well it's just debt relief for Africa, rather than recognizing that different countries may need actual different solutions.
The problem with that, Robert, is that, you know, you don't want to hold the people hostage for some people who are corrupt as leaders. And so the issue is, are you trying to deal with those leaders by themselves, or you're really trying to help the people? And that's the flaw I see in your argument.
And, Don, it seems to me, Don Turner Trice, that even in looking at this, if you follow Robert's suggestion there, the paternalism that we hear so often from the Middle East when you talk about the United States and who gets what money, if you follow our democratic roadmap, echoes there. And even in Africa, sometimes that is looked at with a jaundiced eye.
Well, I mean, we have, I think that the one of the biggest problems here is that when we talk about Africa, there really isn't this very clear roadmap or plan on how to fix things. And when we talk about, we can talk about Iraq or Afghanistan, and things may be, the floor plan may be, or the blueprints may be a little shaky there as well. But, I mean, there tends to be very, very little when it comes to Africa. And so anything that we do, I mean, the $600 million, which is part of that, part of an existing $1.4 billion package that's already been pledged, it seems, I mean, depending on how much you know about this, I mean, it may skew the reality of what's going on.
And I think the reality of the United States is a mixed one. We give, and we should say this, more money than any other industrialized country, but we give the least amount when measured against our ability to pay.
Exactly.
All right. Let us move on to taking a look at what a panel is suggesting about the FBI since 9/11. There was so much talk about transforming the FBI and the CIA and the intelligence world, but what we see, according to this report, is that the FBI has stumbled badly in attempts to remake itself since September 11th, and that it's plagued with poor training, high turnover, a continued inability to build a modern computer system. One would almost believe that unbelievable, if you will. One former deputy attorney general said he was, quote, taken aback by the extent of the FBI's failure to document several recent reports and their inability to get everything together based on the need to shore up this agency. George Curry, does this strike you as strange based on all of what we've seen in terms of trying to shore up our land?
Doesn't really surprise me. I mean, the FBI came under criticism after Watergate for being politicized. We've had this problem, of course, now with you're kind of transforming the FBI. You're getting it more involved with terrorism, and there's a greater reliance or need for reliance on computers and these sorts of things. And it, quite frankly, it's just not coordinated. The problem is the FBI and the CIA.
Amazingly enough, I'm going to completely agree with George on this, and in fact, I'm going
to... What, Robert?
I know, hey. Well, even a stop clock is right once a day, George.
Twice a day.
Twice, yeah.
Well, it depends on whether it's digital. The fact is that not only is the FBI still dysfunctional and they haven't fixed it up. I mean, yesterday you've got a Senate panel wanting to grant them new powers under the Patriot Act. I mean, as a libertarian conservative, my feeling here is you don't give a government agency, whatever it is, expanded power when it's very clear that the powers that they had before have been used irresponsibly. So I mean, this really is a fiasco.
I think that there is some good news here, that's that the bipartisan 9/11 commission, now reconstituted as the 9/11 Public Discourse Project, still is around to address these issues. We as Americans tend to become complacent, or we have a little bit of ADD when it comes to these types of things, and we need this entity to stay on these agencies to improve the chances that they will enact the recommendations of the 9/11 commission. And they've got to fix these things, and we can't wait for someone, a deep throat type, to blow the whistle here. We have to stay on them.
Yeah, George, does this speak to the idea of what many Americans fear, and that is that if we saw another attack, we're not much better off than we were in 2001?
Oh, I don't know. I'd just go that far and say we're not much better off. I think we are better off, but there are so many ways that we are vulnerable, we can never really, really feel secure about it. I mean, I think that's where it is. It's just a hard thing to defend against.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move to an interesting story we found, and we wanted to talk about this. And that's the idea that there are some teenagers who are receiving scholarships. Most recently, this past Tuesday, a 19-year-old received a $5,000 scholarship to go to college. Not necessarily an unusual thing to happen, except for the fact that the money is coming from a group of inmates who are on death row. And there are a group of what they're calling compassionate inmates who are collecting money around the country and providing scholarships to young people, particularly those who are going into law enforcement and want to better themselves. Robert, does this strike you as strange?
I mean, it's strange, but I mean, I think it's refreshing and inspiring in many ways that you know, those who realize that they have made I mean, I say this in a serious way, you know, fatal errors along the road, that they realize that there's a way for them to kind of to give back to society. And I mean, I think it's a really wonderful story.
We should note that this money is solicited through a bi-monthly publication called Compassions, and they've given out $27,000 worth of scholarships to date, and all of the money, or most of the money, the majority of the money, again, comes from death row inmates who send it in and build the scholarship.
Yeah, keep in mind, I remember a few years ago when they had those kind of scared straight programs where you had kind of inmates trying to show wayward kids what was good. The mistakes that they made and how to avoid them in the future. I mean, I think this is kind of a positive flip side of that.
I think it's significant that these people are on death row. You know, they really don't have anything to gain from this, knowing that they're not going to be around long, and they are taking on this initiative. I agree with you, Rob. It's great news.
Yeah, and one of the things that I thought was interesting was that the kid himself, Zach Osborne, said that he felt a little weird at first about applying for the scholarship. He had to write an essay, and he didn't think that people on death row would think that his story was about his 4-year-old sister who was raped and murdered by the mother's boyfriend, and he didn't think that people on death row would find this to be a heinous crime. So he was a little concerned about that in the beginning, but he said that his mother, who learned about the scholarship in the Compassion magazine, wanted him to apply for it because he needs the money, and his tuition costs him like $10,000 a year, and the scholarship $5,000 would pay for a semester. So he was very excited about it, and he received it yesterday.
There are those who will say that we should look to this, to institute this, to implement this as a payback to society, that maybe we should pass legislation that would make this mandatory for prisoners to provide dollars back to society in a form like this.
Well, we already have programs across the state, many states, where any money that a victim would get, I mean, a of a prisoner would get would go get to victims first. I mean, I know like Mamir case in Philadelphia. We had, when I was editor of Emerge magazine, he wanted to write a story for us. And there's a state victim board saying if any money would come to the board, not to Mamir. And so I think we have a lot of this in place. But I don't think you can write any law that make people voluntarily give money to scholarship as they're doing in this case.
Yeah, I think making it mandatory kind of defeats the whole point. And that is, if you're trying to redeem, or you want to, if these part of this is that the prisoners have to feel something. It's nice that the scholarship, I mean, that's a very, the monetary, it's a tangible thing. But I mean, there's that other redemption element to that, and that's something that you can't legislate.
Yeah, I mean,
Robert.
These are people who, you know, in a sense, you know, they've ended lives, and so they're on death row. And this, in a sense, gives them a chance to maybe make some, in their view, a spiritual gesture to improve the lives of younger people. And it's a good way, and it's something that obviously they can't really be forced. Otherwise, it's not really compassion.
And George, does it matter if it is through a redemptive spirit or not?
Well, I think that the donation within themselves, since they know the cause, is just that. And I think that should be taken at face value. I mean, these are people that everybody talk about. These are people who committed crimes, and still, even in their circumstances, they're saying, this is what we want to do. I'll take it for at face value.
All right, and we should note that death row prisoners contribute artwork, essays, and poetry to Compassion, which is a project of the Roman Catholic Church's Peace and Justice Committee. All right, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, Robert George, editorial writer for the New York Post, and Don Turner Trice, reporter and columnist for the Chicago Tribune. We thank all of you for joining us this day.
All right, thank you.
Ed.